to Shattering Mist. We haven't covered this now in a month of Sundays, as the preacher would say, although I would only know from ancient history and that I haven't been inside of a church in more than a decade, and don't intend to. That's not quite true. I did, at my wife's pleading, sit there grumbling under my breath as my nephew was married, because it was an important family event. But other than that, I haven't been inside of a church in a month of Sundays. But we're going to return to Questioning Paul. Kirk, it's been a long time, but do you recall kind of where I know where we were. I'm just out of curiosity. What topic Paul was talking about in his first letter, that's to the Galatians. Do you have kind of an idea as to what the topic was that was high on Paul's agenda as he was writing this rebuttal to the Jerusalem Council, where he was taken to task for his preaching and the fact that his preaching was so anti-Torah?
Well, we know this one is circumcision. That's his big deal.
Circumcision. That was his big deal.
If you're not circumcised, you can't do Passover. Therefore, you're doomed from the get-go. So that would be where you would attack if you hated the Torah.
How many uncircumcised men are part of the covenant?
None.
How many uncircumcised men are in heaven?
None.
Does God give us some wiggle room, a glimmer of hope for those who are uncircumcised, that just perhaps he might acquiesce? All, you know, if Christians would say he's all loving, he's all forgiving. Is there any possibility, based upon what he said, that an uncircumcised man will ever enter heaven, will ever be allowed to participate in the covenant, will ever be welcomed at Passover?
There are five things you agree to if you want to be part of his family. That happens to be one of them, and there is no wiggle room.
No, in fact, he says through his prophets that the most despicable teaching that has been promoted by Israelites, or a Israelite, doesn't specify the number, is this notion that uncircumcised men are welcome in heaven. To my knowledge, there's really only one Jew that promoted that, because those rabbinic Jews, religious Jews, those promoting Judaism are all advocates of circumcision. I only know of one Jew who conceived a religion whereby circumcision was considered detrimental, and that being uncircumcised is what garnered you favor with God.
Mm-hmm. The most quoted individual in the world, Shaul.
Shaul, yeah. Paul.
Paul.
Absolutely. So when God said that this false teaching, which said that uncircumcised men were welcome into heaven, was the single most egregious crime that's ever been perpetrated.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about Shaul, Paul, founder of the Christian religion.
Yeah.
Now, what's also interesting here is that why do you think that God is saying that not only is there no uncircumcised man in heaven and never will be, and that that a religion that suggests that it's possible is such an egregious crime? Why is God so opposed to the notion of an uncircumcised man in heaven? Because, you know, we are going to be spirits in heaven. We're not going to have bodies. So the circumcision is not a physical thing in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So why is God so opposed to it, you think?
Well, you know, he's big on symbols, and it's a symbol of separation.
You know? Yes.
And so,
what is it the sign of?
It's the sign of the covenant. But I mean, it's
okay. How many families does God have?
He has one family.
How many homes does he have?
He has one home and one door to get in.
Is covenant the Hebrew word for family and home?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And so God has one home and one family. His home happens to be heaven. His family is the covenant family. He only has one home, one family. And the sign of that home and family, the sign that says, I am part and I want to be part of that home and family, is circumcision.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not circumcised, you can't be part of that family, and you can't be part of that home. You've said, no, I don't want to be part of that family and home.
Yeah.
So what he's saying, and for those who are thoughtful, those willing to make a connection, that if you're not engaged in the covenant, you can't enter his home. That's what he's saying. What he's looking for is the sign of the covenant to see if you are a member of the covenant, so that you can engage in his home, enter his home. If you don't have the sign of the covenant, you can't enter his family. You cannot enter heaven. That's what he's saying.
Yes.
Because the covenant is the prerequisite for being entering God's home. But let's take the other approach. What he says, if you're not circumcised, you can't participate in Passover. Why would he say that?
Well, because because if you actually knew what you were doing in Passover,
mm-hmm.
Passover gives you eternal life. And eternal life would be eternally separated is what you would be.
Right, because you're not a member of the covenant family. God's only going to save and perfect and enrich and empower his covenant children. He says so over and over again. So under that basis, if you were uncircumcised, you're not a member of the covenant, and you took place at part in Passover, you become immortal.
Mm-hmm.
But immortal, forever estranged from
right.
God's family.
And that's the most heinous crime of all when you view it that way. You recognize what's going on there. That's Satan's big whoop-de-doo.
No, absolutely. That would be his ultimate dream.
Nothing
wish.
Better. Nothing
yeah,
better.
Because that would cause all of humanity, if they celebrated what occurred on Passover, which Christians do when they, that's their Easter week,
right.
That's their Good Friday. If you celebrate what happened in you and you what happened on Passover through their Good Friday, and you are not circumcised and you're not a member of the covenant, you can't be saved. But you're immortal at that point.
Mm-hmm.
That means that your soul is off to Sheol, which is called hell by Christians. That's the consequence. Now, Christians will claim that baptism replaced circumcision.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what did God say about circumcision? Did he say that you could view circumcision strictly symbolically, strictly spiritually? Or did he make a distinction and say that you have to be circumcised of the flesh and of the spirit?
Mm-hmm. Both.
Yeah, both.
Yeah, both.
Both.
Both. Both.
So this is not a situation, you know, there's some things in the Torah where you can read them and say, you know, that is spiritual advice. You know, he's got, I think it's three of the animals that are listed in the this is not food category.
Done.
That didn't exist at the time, don't exist now, have never existed. And so he's not talking about a specific animal, but what that animal represents.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's lots of things in the Torah that speak of what something represents. And when you understand what it represents, that's really God's goal in that regard. But in the case of circumcision, he doesn't give you that option, does he?
No, no, not at all.
You're either circumcised of the spirit and the flesh, or it doesn't count.
And it's volitional. I mean, you can always walk away and say no.
That's right.
It's not like it's a command. That it commands you have to do it whether you like it or not.
Right.
You're not a slave. If you, but
right.
If you say you want to join this is
yeah.
the deal. This
right.
is the contract. Here's that.
Right.
I promise this, you do this.
That's right. It's like when you get married. There's a marriage vow, and both parties, husband and wife, vow to do certain things and to expect certain things. And the covenant is the same way. God asks certain things of us, and he promises certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So it tells us what we can expect. And in the covenant, you do not have to agree to any of these things. And if you don't agree to them, you're not going to hell.
No.
No punishment. You just can't be part of his family unless you agree to the terms and conditions of the family. And if you do, then God is bound to provide his benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. You aren't required to be circumcised as a man.
No.
Unless, of course, you want to be immortal. You want to be perfected. You want to know who Yahweh is. You want to understand what he's offering. You want to engage in a relationship with him. You want to spend eternity in his home. If those things are true, circumcision by itself won't give you any of those things.
No.
But the lack of circumcision will preclude you from having those things.
Yes, but it is.
And, you know, women, your wife might say, for example, you know, well, what is the sign for a woman? It's the same. That's not for her to be circumcised. The instruction on the covenant is that we as parents are asked to circumcise our male, our sons, our males, on the eighth day.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't tell you how much to cut off. It doesn't tell you who has to do the snipping. So it's very much like trying to ascertain the days of the specific days that the Moed Mikra are to be observed on. Thinking people can come to very different conclusions as to how much and who, but God specifically does not tell us, because it's not about the how much and it's not about who does it. He says nothing about the setting. He just says that as parents, we're to circumcise our sons on the eighth day. So when a child is born, who is the primary custodian of that child when it is 8 days old?
The mother, primarily.
You betcha. So it's, you want to know what the mother's sign is? To do this for her sons so that she remembers and they remember the covenant. That's so it is very much presented as a motherly choice, the sign of the covenant. And it just happens to be the fifth condition for participating in the covenant. And it's the fifth for a reason. It says, okay, once you understand what God is offering, once you've come to know him and choose that you want to spend eternity with him, this is the sign. Welcome back to Shattering Mess. We're talking about the Great Divide, of course. That is the dividing line, the fulcrum that differentiates Pauline Christianity from the Torah. And the reason that one thing was chosen is really quite ingenious with circumcision. Why do you think Paul chose circumcision to be the fulcrum upon which he would move in the opposite direction of God?
He's involved in Greek thought, you know, that was abhorrent to them. I mean, mm-hmm. He was inspired. He's the only quote-unquote man of God who has the audacity to tell everyone he's I'm possessed. Obviously inspired. Inspired.
What you've said in terms of Greek philosophy is I think I don't know if it's 50% complete or 80% complete, but it's somewhere between the two.
But that, you go into that frame, and we find that abhorrent.
Correct. The only thing that would add to why he played it that way, from the antagonist's point of view versus Yahweh's point of view, would be also Roman thought. Who was Rome's at this time around? 70 to 80 CE. Who at that time was the most hated people in the world by Rome? Whom the only people that they had fought not one but two wars against in the 50 years prior to that time.
Yeah, that was obviously Israel.
Actually, one war prior, one war would follow immediately thereafter. One fought around 70 CE, the other one 133 to 135 CE. So it's right in between the two wars against Israel. Makes the point even more valid. And what was the Roman means of determining, because they, you know, there wasn't much difference in the way that the Persians looked, for example, and the way that they, because they, you know, Babylon and
300,000 of them went to Babylon, so
yeah. Right, and of course they came back from Babylon, and Abraham was a Babylonian after all. He came out of Babylon. So did his wife Sarah.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't have looked racially any different than the Persians that they were fighting here and there at that time. So what was the means that the Romans used to determine whether or not they were going to kill you?
Circumcision.
You betcha. So that was the sign of the enemy in Roman thought.
Mm-hmm.
And make no mistake, the people Rome despised the most at this time, overwhelmingly, wasn't the Visigoths, wasn't the Gauls, it was the Jews. Far and away. I mean, no one anywhere close to the Jews in terms of enemies. So part of it's Roman thought. Now, in Greek thought, are you familiar with the principal Greek religious and philosophical viewpoint at this time in history, what it was called?
Gnosticism?
Yes, yeah, correct. Yep, Gnosticism was essentially the religion and political mantra of Socrates and Plato and of Aristotle, and it held the view that that which was of the flesh, or that which was worldly or material, was an inferior, faulty, errant, and evil shadow of that which was perfect. And so the spiritual was perfect and the material was flawed.
Mm-hmm.
So circumcision of the flesh would be an act that would be evil,
mm-hmm.
flawed, corrupt, a negative thing, where that which is spirit would be positive. So Paul chose to play right into Gnosticism, Greek religion and philosophy, by condemning that which was of the flesh. In fact, he writes in Galatians, he has a whole diatribe of the flesh versus of the spirit, and the from Paul's point of view, because the Torah insists on circumcision as the sign of the covenant, it's of the flesh, and therefore it's evil.
So that means you cannot teach matzah.
That's correct.
Because you cannot say, walk to me, physically walk to me.
Right.
And become
right.
Perfect.
That is correct. So it appealed to Romans. It appealed to Greeks. Not and a total disregard, a hatred for circumcision appealed to Romans because they were their enemies. And appealed to Greeks because of Gnosticism. So it appealed to his audience. And, of course, it destroyed the relationship with Yahweh. So here we have Paul who sought to be believed. And if you read Paul's first five letters, the letter to the Galatians, both letters to the Thessalonians, both letters to the Corinthians, even Christians will acknowledge, any Christian scholar will acknowledge,
yeah,
that Paul was up in arms, that he was really pissed off, that in all of those letters, he is condemning those that he spoke to because they turned on him. They rejected what he had to say once he left, that they pretended to go along, and that Paul was desperate to get them to reject their negative conclusion of him and believe that he cannot lie, that he is the apostle of God, that God gave him control of the entire world, and that he alone has the means to heaven. That when someone didn't believe him, he went berserk. His letters are really hateful and insulting of the audience in Thessalonica, Corinth, and Galatia.
Yes.
And so you have him trying to appeal to the soft spot, Gnosticism for the Greeks, anti-Semitism for the Romans. So you have him trying to appeal to them, and yet even when he makes that appeal right in their soft spot, they're still rejecting him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a reason that Paul chose circumcision beyond the fact that it would have made him immensely more popular with Gentiles, Romans and Greeks, than had he not drawn his line in the sand there.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you oppose the Torah on the thing that is considered the most repulsive to Greeks and Romans who influence most of the world at this time,
mm-hmm.
that's going to make you popular, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
But on the other side, if you oppose the Torah on the issue of circumcision, the sign, the very sign, there's only one sign of the covenant. On the sign of the covenant, and it, you're working for the opposing side. You're working for the adversary, Hasatan.
Mm-hmm.
What strategy would be better than opposing the covenant on its lone sign?
You couldn't come up with something better than what they did.
You know, you can oppose Passover and people simply die.
Mm-hmm.
You can oppose matzah and no sin is forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
You can oppose the Torah's guidance and people are just lost.
Mm-hmm.
But if you oppose circumcision and then you celebrate on a warped way what happened on Passover with the crucifixion and you form a religion that says your God died to save you and you celebrate Passover that way, then you have all of humanity that buys into that damned. It's going to spend eternity with Satan. There's nothing you could have done strategically from the adversarial point of view that would have been as damning as what Paul did, which is to preclude entrance into the covenant.
Well, you know, I understand why Paul is doing it. I mean, he was a wannabe rabbi, at least, and he understood these things. So
but the rabbi in him would have been in favor of circumcision.
It would, so, but I mean, but his training would allow him to know both sides of the coin, so he would not have been ignorant of what he was doing.
Oh, no, he was not ignorant. Oh, there's no question. This is not I just goofed. I misunderstood.
Yeah. Oh, no. But
oh, no. This is the entire foundation of Paul's argument is that circumcision is of the flesh. Therefore, the Torah is of the flesh. That which is of the flesh is evil. Therefore, the Torah is evil.
Yeah, he's thought this out. He's thought this out.
Oh, yeah. That's the foundation of Pauline Christianity. And the foundation, while it appealed to the Greek mindset and to the Roman mindset, was the antithesis of what God said. And as such, what do you think just run the odds here for me. What are the odds that somebody who is going to undermine the single most important thing that God said, God's very foundation, which is the sign of the covenant, and his Torah teaching, laying the foundation and the guidance to his covenant family. What do you think the odds are that somebody could call that pornography, could demean it to say that plan that God enabled can't save and that it enslaves when God says that it liberates? What is the likelihood that person was authorized not only to speak for God, but was given the entire world to speak for him?
Yeah, you can't get there unless you never read the five conditions. I mean, just can't go. You can't go there from there.
You either have to be ignorant of the Torah,
uh-huh, or just hate,
or wholly irrational, where you cannot form a reasoned conclusion based on the evidence. You're incapable of recognizing that when two people say exactly the opposite things, that one of the two ain't telling the truth.
Mm-hmm. Now, why is it that Rome hated the Israel so much?
Because the Romans were, the Israelites were the only nation that would not capitulate to Roman deity, to Roman supremacy, to Roman ideals, to Roman gods, to the Roman religion. Every other subjected community, the people chose to accept the subjugation of Rome and to accept their deified status, their superior status, godlike status as men, and their Roman way to live. But the Jews were willing to say, rather than accept Roman paganism, rather than acknowledge Romans as God, rather than accept Roman law, we'd rather die. That's why.
Well, I mean, I know that's the answer. I just, from a Roman standpoint, it seems like they would have just done like the Muslim, just tax them extra and forget it.
They did. What they ended up doing is that when they wouldn't do that, then they forced every Jewish male to serve in the Roman army.
Agent.
And yeah, and so they took all the men away, and then they put more and more legions there to control them, and then what happened? The two most egregious. The only Roman war more savage. More ruthless than was the first Roman assault on Israel was their final war against Carthage, where the Carthaginians did not do anything that was inappropriate with Rome. Rome was the antagonizer all the way through and manipulated the war because they wanted to annihilate Carthage. So their destruction of Carthage would have been more ruthless than was, and more unjustified, perhaps even, than Rome's first assault on Israel in 70 CE. But Rome's second assault, the Hadrian assault on Israel, where Hadrian said, well, I'm inviting all the Jews back, all these Israelites back, and we're going to rebuild the Jerusalem that you know, we Romans destroyed, and we'll rebuild the temple, and you just all come back now, and this will be really good. And he lured them all back, and then he says, oh, by the way, it's going to be a temple to me and a temple to Jupiter, and we're going to rename the city after me, and on top of all that, we're going to make this a place where the legionaries can come for vacation. And then he set out to slaughter them, and you'd even have to say, Kirk, that when Rome in 70 used the great treasure in Yahweh's temple to finance the construction of the Colosseum. Yeah. And they used the slave labor from enslaved Israelites to build the Colosseum. And you have the contrast between Yahweh's home, his temple in Jerusalem, and the Colosseum in Rome, which was the single most despicable arena for human behavior in the history of mankind.
Yeah, way past the Nazis.
Oh, yeah, there is no spectacle in all of human history that rivals the depravity of what took place in the Colosseum. And so that is the ultimate contrast between that which is of Yahweh and that which is of man. And it's why Yahweh went on to say that Rome would be the single most ruthless and vicious animal in all of human history, but that Rome would not die. That Rome would continue right through the last days. And it has, the Roman Catholic Church. There was never a more overt enemy of Yahweh's chosen people than Rome. I mean, the Babylonians for a brief while, the Assyrians for a brief while, the Egyptians for a brief while, the Hittites for a brief while, the Philistines for a brief while were enemies of Yahweh's chosen people. And now, for the last 1400 years, the Muslims. But no one in all of human history were as ruthless, as depraved towards Yahweh's chosen people than the Romans. And that's why it's just so telling that Christianity grew out of that. It's the Roman Catholic Church.
Well, that makes pause to think, or should.
Yeah, what did the, you know, under Hadrian, what did the Romans do with those who were Hebrew scholars and with the actual Torah that they were studying and reading from? You know?
They wrapped them up and burned them with the Torah on them.
That is correct.
And I think they delayed the burning or wet.
Yeah, they actually moistened the Torahs that they would wrap around these people so that they would die slowly. That's how depraved the Romans were.
These are the people that had the crucifixion to a fine art. I mean, this is pretty...
Yeah, Hadrian made all things Yahweh illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Passover was illegal. It was illegal to celebrate Matzah. It was illegal to be circumcised. It was illegal to own a copy of the Torah, to read the Torah. It was illegal to honor and observe the Shabbat. It was illegal to do anything that Yahweh asked to be done. Rome set itself out as the opposite of Yahweh. And the Roman Catholic Church grew right out of Rome. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. If there were one myth we could shatter, if I were given just the opportunity, Kirk, to say, there's only, you only get one shot.
One shot, okay.
One shot. What myth do you think that I would choose to shatter if I only had one? There's 1,000 myths out there. Which one do you think I would most like to shatter?
Paul.
Yeah, Pauline Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity, based on its New Testament, half of the books written by Paul, and really 100% of the basis of Christianity being Paul.
Who saved him?
Who saved what?
The Paul's letters.
Yeah, it's, Paul's letters were both popular and unpopular. It's an interesting history. When you read his third letter, I don't know if it's his second or his third letter to Titus, not to Titus, but Timothy. He admits to Timothy, who he has out there in Ephesus, trying to condemn the teaching of Yahweh Kanan. So he is overtly condemning everything that Yahweh Kanan, the disciple whom Yosha not only loved, but the disciple, not Paul, that Yosha chose to reveal revelation to.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, his birth mother, Mary, was under Yahweh Kanan's care, not Paul's. Paul had nothing to do with Yosha, never met him, never did nothing to him. Paul, because he realized that the disciples, particularly Yahweh Kanan, was his primary, most formidable foe, had Timothy out there in Ephesus to try to undermine Yahweh Kanan. And so in that letter, he says that he is all alone, that everyone has deserted him, which means I think even Luke deserted him.
Mm-hmm.
I think he says it. He says, everyone's deserted me. I don't have a single friend left in the world. No one. And for him, his view wouldn't be, friendship wouldn't be, in his view, somebody to go off and I don't know what sports they played, but to go throw a javelin with. You know, they didn't go off play. Yeah, they didn't play golf back in the day. His view of being abandoned means that everyone that he tried to influence rejected him. So his letters and his preaching had failed completely. Everyone rejected him. And it wasn't hard. I mean, all you had to do is he was claiming to be the lone spokesperson for God, and yet the very people who Yosha picked and had trained to speak for him were saying the opposite of what he was saying. And he was condemning the very testimony of the God that he claimed had authorized him. So you didn't have to be the sharpest tool in the shed to figure out the guy was a con man. And, of course, his whole rhetoric was just, he contradicts himself. Any person schooled in rhetoric, which the Romans and Greeks were, anybody schooled in rhetoric would have recognized that instantly that Paul was a fraud. So he was completely abandoned and completely alone. So he had failed entirely. So what happened? Well, how did he become the basis of Christianity? And the answer really is twofold. One is a fellow named Marcion. Marcion was a overt Gnostic. And he realized that Paul's letters advanced Gnosticism. And so Marcion tried to create a religion of Christianity, and he had lots of money. He was a real merchant of the day, shipping enterprise. He would have been the Onassis of his day. He put all of his money behind codifying Paul's letters as the scripture of what was essentially a Gnostic religion. And he promoted Paul and came up with a codex of Paul's letters. Papyrus 46 is essentially that. And then, Marcion became extraordinarily powerful because he was the focus of this new religion. The Roman Catholic Church was trying to earn its place, and so it labeled Marcion a heretic, but they accepted everything that Marcion had said and done. You know, just as the Roman Catholic Church accepted Sunday worship and Easter and Christmas and all these other pagan ideas. And then at the Council of Nicaea, and then later under both Constantine and Theodosius, the religion of Christianity was promoted on Paul's letters. He's the one. He was resurrected from the dead.
I guess.
We'll be back tomorrow.